Point AK.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Audi. The road is calling. Embrace the thrill of the drive with the all-new, fully electric Audi Q6 e-tron. Featuring effortless power, serious acceleration, and advanced Audi tech. It's not just a new EV. It's a new way to experience driving. The all-new, fully electric Audi Q6 e-tron is here. The next chapter of Audi starts now.
Today at T-Mobile, I'm joined by a special co-anchor.
What up, everybody? It's your boy, Big Snoop D-O-double-G.
Snoop, where can people go to find great deals?
Head to T-Mobile.com and get four iPhone 16s with Apple Intelligence on us, plus four lines for $25.
That's quite a deal, Snoop. And when you switch to T-Mobile, you can save versus the other big guys, comparable plans plus streaming.
Respect. When we up out of here.
See how you can save on wireless and streaming versus the other big guys at T-Mobile.com/switch. Apple Intelligence requires iOS 18.1 or later.
Hi, it's Seth. As you're aware, the funding for science is under attack. That threatens science research. This week's episode explores how firing federal workers and freezing grants has thrown science research into turmoil. Our ability to bring you episodes about such critical issues depends on your support. And as a way of keeping Big Picture Science going, I hope you'll become one of our subscribers on Patreon at patreon.com/bigpicturescience. Patreon supporters have early access to ad-free versions of every episode, as well as bonus perks available at different donation levels. Now is the time to stand up for science, and this is a way to do it that makes a big difference. Your support is invaluable. Please join us at patreon.com/bigpicturescience. Thank you.
The word data may cause eyes to glaze over. It sounds dry and super abstract. What it refers to can be anything but those things, as we'll hear. But in my family, the word itself has been a source of lively debate. As scientists, non-scientists, all ages, we have argued whether data should be treated as a singular or plural noun. Technically, data is the plural form because Latin, but some in our family insist that it is fine to say the data is important because that's how it's used in casual conversation. My octogenarian father, however, a scientist, always remained firm. Data was plural, and he didn't care if the sentence, "these data are important," sounded stuffy. It was correct. Well, you'll hear the use of both in this show. Our language changes, but our reliance on data does not. Data underpin all science. Whether scientists are measuring the temperature of the ocean, mapping star clouds of the galaxy, or tallying the number and the kind of species in the rainforest, collection and interpretation of data is how we further science. It's how we understand our world across all disciplines. The decision by the current administration to cut science jobs and funding raises the possibility of interruption or termination of data collection across many fields. The policies are still unfolding, but the questions they raise are worth considering now. What might it mean if important data are no longer collected or if access to them is curtailed? Welcome to Big Picture Science. I'm Molly Bentley.
I'm Seth Shostak. In this episode, we consider what it means to our lives when the collection and publishing of information go away. This episode is called Disappearing Data. We'll talk about what might happen when researchers at the CDC and NOAA are prevented from collecting, analyzing, or releasing data. But first, we hear about an area of basic research where funding cutoff is not getting much attention. I personally believe basic research may be the most important research that scientists do. When many people think of research, they picture the development of new materials or new medications. In other words, they think of work that leads to new practical applications. But basic research is not done for those reasons. It's motivated simply by curiosity. When Newton formulated his laws of motion in the 1600s, it wasn't with the ambition of producing rockets. It was just because he was interested in describing and possibly even understanding how nature works. Of course, basic research can lead to practical applications too, and in the long run, usually does.
Kimberly Cooper is a cell and developmental biologist at the University of California, San Diego. Her lab is home to multiple researchers working on many projects, and a lot of them are basic research. She has yet to receive funds allocated for the third year of a four-year grant from the National Institutes of Health. One of the projects that may be suffering funding cuts is one that uses mouse genomes to study complex genetic diseases, including Alzheimer's and heart disease. But her primary area of study is evolutionary biology.
We know a lot about how bones grow. We've been studying the skeleton for decades, but most of what we know about how bones grow is how all bones grow. What I think is fascinating is that we still don't know why we have long arm and leg bones and short hand and foot bones in people. And we don't know why bats have stretched their fingers out to form wings and why horses have a single toe on each of their four limbs. So that's what my lab has been interested in trying to find out.
I'm very naive about these things, but it just seems to me that you would want to have a kind of a skeletal structure that would allow you to pick things up, like dinner, for example. So having, you know, long arms and relatively short bones in your hand sounds to me like the optimal engineering for doing that.
Because of selection. Because the environment determines the need, and the body responds to the selection. And the way the body responds to the selection is by certain individuals having a more optimal body shape, hand shape. And so their genes are preferentially passed to the next generation. And over many, many millions of years, that will reshape the skeleton and all the different species that we see today.
So would you say that this kind of work, your research, would you call that basic research?
It is absolutely basic research, and it's the foundation of all of research science in the world.
Well, at least in this field, yes.
I think that even engineering is based on discoveries and basic questions. We ask questions, we answer questions, and that's really the definition of basic research. And when there's an opportunity to apply what we've learned by asking questions, that's translational, and that leads to engineering. But the foundation of all science is asking and answering questions.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've talked to people about the value of basic research, because I think that for the public, for many members of the public, right, they figure that scientists ought to be working on, if you will, applied research, right? Here's a problem over here, maybe heart disease or Alzheimer's. I think that's something you work on. And let's do some research to fix that problem without realizing that maybe the quickest way to getting to a solution to, say, Alzheimer's might be by doing basic research. Would you make that argument?
I think even with my own research, I'm actually not directly addressing Alzheimer's. My lab is not researching Alzheimer's, but inspired by basic genetics, we're building tools in mice to be able to assemble complexes of mutations that could be causative of any number of diseases, and Alzheimer's is one of them. So we got started because we were interested in how your skeleton develops different proportions and how that differs in other species. We realized that's really complicated to study, and lots of other things are complicated to study in mice. And so a lot of our mouse work is trying to improve the tools to efficiently study complex genetic traits that involve more than three or four genes. And so in a way, by supporting the research that my lab does to try to understand how we can increase inheritance in mice, we make the study of Alzheimer's more possible, and heart disease, and stroke, and diabetes, and creating these mouse models, generating these mouse models that can then be used to test therapeutic approaches. That's absolutely right.
Your research is in part funded by grants from government agencies, such as National Institutes of Health. Or what research projects are you currently working on under NIH grants?
I have multiple funding sources in the lab. So I have a research group. There are 6 people working with me. I write grants all the time. So I have multiple grants that are funding different aspects of what my lab does. One of those aspects is this complex genetic mouse model that is funded by NIH through this one grant, but it is not the only grant that my lab has. I currently have a grant from the National Institute for General Medical Sciences. This is NIGMS. It's one of the NIH institutes. It's an R01. This is kind of the standard research grant that supports most labs. And depending on the institute, these are grants for 4 or 5 years of funding. And they're the bread and butter. These are the grants that support multiple individuals to carry a research project over a period of time, and they are renewable. And so in theory, if you complete the objectives of a project and you write a renewal application, you can get that grant funded again for another 4 or 5 years. And so the NIH is supporting the continuance, this sort of stable continuance of funding for many labs around the country that are continuing to be successful and productive and are therefore able to secure more funding year over year.
So, Kim, how have these projects that you're working on been disrupted by the recent cuts to NIH funding?
I think the biggest disruption right now for me personally is the uncertainty, because I have a dozen or so different configurations of these mouse models. They're expensive to maintain. I have staff. I have a postdoctoral fellow and a technician that are paid by this grant that are conducting this research. The uncertainty is that I have a funded award. We've completed 2 years of the studies, and I'm expecting the third year allocation to come about 6 weeks ago. And so the delay of that allocation means that my projects are currently unfunded until they become funded. And I'm not sure if that money is coming, and I'm having to continue to make decisions about keeping these mice going and funding my staff, hoping that we'll be able to continue doing this research. And it pays the cost of about 200 cages of mice. Now, these are lines that we spent about $150,000 engineering and obtaining these animals. It pays for their care. And if the funding stops, we have to euthanize these animals. We have to terminate the work, not just terminate the work, but we have to terminate these lines that are being used for studies. And everything that we've done up to this point will have been for nothing, because we won't be able to complete the research.
Okay, well, I just want people to understand that if this government money goes away, this research essentially goes away. Sounds to me like that's what you're saying. It's very simple.
Absolutely. If the funding goes away, the university does not have the resources to fund this research. And so the research will end. Research happens because of a federal investment in research. And I imagine one of the reasons that I'm here with my grant still in uncertainty, as opposed to you talking with someone who has already had a grant terminated, because there are now hundreds of researchers across this country that have had terminated awards. Their life is currently in complete chaos because they're having to right now make these hard decisions about which staff members get laid off and which resources they can try to save. And they don't have the time to sit for an interview.
Yeah. The NIH, obviously, that's tax dollars. But what fraction of your work would you say is actually funded by the government as opposed to being funded privately?
Right. So in my specific case, I would say about 50% of my work is federally funded and 50% is funded through private grants. That formula of private versus federal funding will be different for every lab across the country. Some labs rely 100% on federal funding. So if the federal funding withdraws, the lab closes. Whereas others may be able to weather this for a little bit, but if the federal money goes away, that is the largest source of biomedical research funding, not only in the United States, but in the entire world. And if that goes, it's like a vacuum. You're just leaving behind this enormous need that's not going to be filled. And the private sources of money are going to be overtapped. And so there's not enough private money to replace what the government has done.
I you know, my impression has always been that following the dramatic Sputnik moment, the missile gap, you're probably too young to remember that, but I do remember it. That was the late 1950s, and the whole country got upset about it, and suddenly government funding of science took a, you know, it really went up because the importance of basic research, which is what you say you're doing, would, you know, simply was underappreciated, at least by the public. Do you think we've sort of reverted to that situation where, you know, a lot of people find it very easy to make an argument, look, if your research isn't focused on some practical application, I'm not going to agree to have my tax dollars supporting it?
I think people are inherently curious. And I think people, not just scientists, but all people want to know answers. I think people take the basic research that gives us these answers for granted. I don't think people don't want to know the answers. I think they don't realize where those answers come from. And you have to think about whether you want to support it or not, because it's been happening and it's about to stop happening. And you're going to stop knowing things because people in this country have been doing it. And you're going to know things because people in other countries will continue doing it.
Is that maybe the way to stop this happening, the curtailing of government funding, to point to the fact that, well, we may not do this basic research to understand, you know, how biology really works, but don't worry, the Europeans will do it or somebody else will do it?
I think so, because this is a lost opportunity for a generation of Americans. These are our current undergraduate students who can't get into PhD programs because we're canceling admissions. I'm the associate director of the PhD program in biological sciences here at UCSD, and we cut our graduate admissions by 30%, and that was early in what's happening now. And a lot of universities have recently been rescinding offers for graduate admissions. So that's a generation of undergrads that will not get to go to graduate school, at least not this year.
Maybe you could address the fact that if you stop basic research, or any kind of research for that matter, restarting it is not as simple as simply, you know, letting people back into the lab and turning on the lights again. It's not necessarily easy to get a program once stopped, started again, right?
That's correct, because there are all sorts of resources that have to be maintained, and there's data that needs to be maintained, because everything that we've already produced, if it's electronic, it's in data storage. If it's in biological resources, it's data storage. My animals that are sitting in a facility, that is data stored in a living animal that we still need to study. And so the timeline is crucial, right? If these disruptions that have already forced people to make some really hard decisions, if the money starts to flow again within the next month or so, then the disruption may be overcomable. But the longer it goes, the more decisions will have to be made that may be irreversible. If I have to sacrifice these mouse lines before we can complete our studies, I have to regenerate these mouse lines. And it took a year to make them in the first place. So it's not just like turning off a switch and turning it back on again, because the decisions that have to be made after that switch is turned off leaves it in a different state so that it doesn't just come back on again.
Yeah, it's not like just losing your glassware. If you're a chemist, this is different. Finally, Kim, I know these unprecedented cuts must be keeping many researchers up at night. What is the general sense in the biology research community?
This is keeping every researcher up at night. And I've heard people compare this to the COVID pandemic lockdowns. And I think we all agree that it is disruptive. And the difference now is that this is an attack on science and we're not seeing an end. And so it feels like a permanence. And what I see in my colleagues is grief. Like everyone is sharing this feeling of grief that what we've been doing is coming apart.
Kimberly Cooper, thanks so very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Kimberly Cooper is a cell and developmental biologist at the University of California, San Diego. Next, what interruptions in CDC data collection might mean for tracking threatening infectious diseases, including avian influenza.
As a journalist, the CDC used to hold briefings fairly regularly on the bird flu, but now that's completely stopped. There are no more briefings with the experts or with the journalists.
We're looking at how the withdrawal of federal funding for science may affect the collection and sharing of important information. This episode is called Disappearing Data. Hey, it's Seth again. As you're aware, science jobs are being cut and funding for science research is shrinking. But the science community is fighting back. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke at the Stand Up for Science demonstration in San Francisco, describing the value of research and what we may lose if drastic funding cuts are implemented. Meanwhile, our assistant producer, Shannon Rose Geary, attended the event in Boston.
I've been having many speakers come up who are concerned about the cuts to science research funding.
Scientists will not be silenced.
Scientists will not be silenced.
You too can stand up for science in a way that makes a big difference by joining our efforts at patreon.com/bigpicturescience. Your support is invaluable. It makes it possible to bring you episodes like this one. Please join us at patreon.com/bigpicturescience. Thank you. Since the beginning of the year, the Trump administration has taken several steps that suggest a government retreat from science. In February, the administration pulled down information from CDC websites and also stopped some publications related to health. Health and behavior data were removed. Links and pages disappeared. Some of those data have been reinstated, but not all of them. This has created uncertainty for doctors who rely on CDC databases.
Doctors across the country refer to the CDC websites frequently, you know, to answer various questions that they have about their patients. For example, if they have a patient that's going on a trip to Egypt, they might look at the CDC website to see what vaccines might they need, do they need malaria medications. If a doctor has a patient who's had a bone marrow transplant, they might look at the website to see, you know, what's the vaccine schedule for that person after the transplant.
We began this episode referring to the confusion over whether the word data is singular or plural. Well, we have an echo of that here. It is sometimes overlooked that the CDC refers to the Centers for Disease Control. That's because the agency comprises many groups covering many aspects of public health and collects data locally from the states about a wide range of issues: infectious diseases, diabetes, opioid overdose, mental health issues, and maternal mortality.
This public health agency helps protect the health and well-being of populations, not just individuals. It shares data with the World Health Organization to create an accurate picture of global health and to spotlight areas of concern. In January, President Trump signed an executive order withdrawing the United States from the World Health Organization.
I'm Amy Maxman, and I'm a public health reporter at KFF Health News.
We discussed with Amy Maxman what the administration's policy changes mean for the CDC, and we spoke with her at the end of February, when some of its studies had gone missing or were delayed. Since then, there have been more changes. For example, there are reports that the Trump administration plans to eliminate the agency's HIV prevention efforts. The situation continues to unfold, but our conversation highlights the role that reliable reports and accurate data play in helping the CDC do its job, which Amy says includes responding to rapidly changing health situations.
One is, you know, in addition to like the more static websites, they also have a lot of dashboards that might provide data on, say, how many people have gotten measles vaccines, or how many people in hospitals during the flu season are sick with flu-like illnesses. So those are sort of dashboards that keep you up to date. How many people have been infected with the bird flu since we've had this most recent outbreak? They also do analyses on this sort of data, especially when there's like emerging worrisome situations. They'll do analyses on the data, and they'll use those analyses to guide doctors or hospitals on what they should do. So for example, maybe it turns out that a lot of these flu-like symptoms actually aren't the flu, but it's some other kind of virus. Well, then you want to know, you know, do you tell those patients to be treated with Tamiflu, a drug, you know, that you use to fight the flu, or do you want to treat it with something else?
And the doctors who have those questions, they get their answers from the CDC website, and things may be changing. It's up to the minute information, and that will guide them in terms of how they respond.
I mean, just it's probably not up to the minute because it takes a little time to like collect the data from localities and states and put it out. But yes, it is timely information, recent, you know, within a couple weeks. They've also, you know, for many decades, you know, at least since the 1950s, they've had this morbidity and mortality weekly report that comes out at least weekly and sometimes more frequently. And that's a report that's often about kind of recent emerging problems, and that will sort of summarize kind of new knowledge in that area.
Well, Amy, let's look at the case of bird flu in light of what's been happening at the CDC recently that has been troubling. Of course, there's a growing concern across the country as more birds and cattle are infected by the H5N1 virus. You have reported that the CDC has cut off communication with doctors and researchers and with the World Health Organization. What's going on?
So it's not a full stop in communication. There was a full pause for 2 or 3 weeks. That's now stopped. But, you know, I've heard all sorts of reports from different people that bits of that communication is now gone. So, for example, as a journalist, the CDC used to hold briefings fairly regularly on the bird flu that were related to new knowledge or new important events that have happened. So they would hold these briefings. They'd hold a briefing with experts, and then they would follow it up with a briefing with journalists. And they would sort of tell it to both of us so that then we go and relay kind of what's going on. So that was what they used to do. And I just say, you know, I was critical of the CDC last year. So it's not like, you know, they've ever been some sort of perfect organization. But now that's completely stopped. There are no more briefings with the experts or with the journalists, at least none of these sort of briefings as they had it before. And there's been developments, like, for example, there's a first hospitalized farm worker from Ohio with the bird flu. Those are the kind of cases where if this was last year's CDC, I know that I'd be getting a notice from the CDC saying there's a press briefing at 11 o'clock on Thursday or something like that. And that's not happening now.
One of the many consequences of this is that reporters can't report on it, so the public doesn't know about it. I mean, so there's a whole chain of communication that goes quiet.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Or I should say, it's not necessarily that it goes quiet. So the problem is that, you know, you'll have some information, and the problem with just having some information is that it creates a lot of confusion and speculation, and you get more speculation. You'll see news articles with people kind of speculating, and really, you just want information, you know, whether it's bad or good, you just want to know what's happening.
So, Amy, the big question is, why has the CDC cut off communication? Why has it gone dark?
And just to be clear, it's not gone completely dark. So sometimes there'll be a website I can't find, and then it's back. And, you know, the CDC has now started putting out its reports, but some are, you know, some of the papers that I was expecting are not in it, but they're still, so it's not a completely dark situation. But yes, why has there been the pauses in communication? Why are there delays? Recently, the committee that advises on immunizations was just, you know, at the last minute, they were stopped from meeting. So why is this happening? It's really hard to figure out exactly why. In some cases, there's been federal orders that have to do with particular words like gender or transgender or diversity that the administration might not want to see out there. In other cases, you know, I think the acting director of HHS had put out a memo about a pause. There's sort of a mix of reasons, and I can't tell you exactly what the strategy is here. Actually, I have no idea what the strategy is.
And I appreciate your nuanced reply that not everything is dark and some data sets are coming back. And it is true that a federal judge ordered the CDC and other health agencies to restore data sets and websites, but just some of them. So that feels encouraging. On the other hand, it's still incomplete.
So a judge ordered the CDC to restore websites. And so a lot of the data has been put back up with sort of language that shows that the administration did so reluctantly and wasn't on board with this. Some might still be gone. When I was reporting my last story about a measles outbreak in West Texas, I was looking for this template of a letter that the CDC offers to principals, school principals, that they can send to parents that basically says, if your kid is unvaccinated and there's a measles outbreak at the school and the kid's exposed, keep them home for 21 days. I couldn't find it anymore. The website where it belonged, you know, just as of December, it's no longer on that website.
And if you can't find it, parents can't find it.
Right, or the school principal can't find it. And so at that point in time, with West Texas, they were still going with what the last guidance was, and you can kind of find it, you know, there's an archive of the CDC you can find, but it's not on the website that you go to for that purpose.
Well, let's take a specific example of why the CDC's ability to assess risk and like coordinate efforts is important, because you mentioned measles and you have reported extensively on this. The measles outbreak in Texas, one could say, is a local outbreak. It's a local event. Why should the CDC get involved, and how does it help people, physicians, individuals, if the CDC does get involved?
So yeah, so when there's outbreaks, typically it's handled at the local level by local health departments and then by the state. So it is something that's handled on the ground. But we want to have the CDC aware of the problem, because different states might report things differently. We want to be able to have national reporting so that the data can be out there for everyone to see, and that the data is collected in the same sort of way. So it's kind of a national repository, because we're all connected. The second thing they do is they provide, there's a lot of researchers within the CDC who provide technical help. So sometimes a state will ask the CDC to actually physically send people to come do some of the epidemiology studies. So that's happened with the bird flu in California. They might ask CDC to come in with their epidemiology prowess and do some work actually there. In other cases, they're there to consult with. So if there's a big measles outbreak, a local public health official might want to know, gee, you know, this is like a situation that happened in Michigan or in New York, and I'd really like to figure out how did health officials handle it. And that's when you'll go to the CDC, who usually has some coordinating role in there, and they can kind of help inform you.
And could you say, with regard to bird flu, for example, this is a developing situation still, why it's so important to have the CDC involved now?
Yeah, so the bird flu is it's a very frightening situation, just in terms of the fact that it could cause a potential pandemic. We're not there yet. There's a lot of unknowns right now with the bird flu. There's a ton of questions that people have, that researchers have around the world, and we have a lot of uncertainty. And so basically, the more uncertainty you have, the less good you are at kind of stopping an outbreak. And outbreaks get bigger the longer you do nothing about them. It's like with a wildfire. You want to put it out. The earlier you put out a wildfire, the better chance you have of containing it. The bigger it gets, the harder it is to contain. So you want to be able to have timely data that will kind of inform us about what is the situation. To name some specific examples, there were a few studies I had been following that I knew would be out in the CDC's journal, and they were delayed, you know, some for 2 weeks, some for 3 weeks, some I still haven't seen. And The problem with that is they just help inform us about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you sort of ignore diseases or health issues, it doesn't mean they go away. And in fact, they only...
They don't ignore you.
They don't ignore you. In fact, they like being ignored. So it's good for them. It's good for kind of viruses for you to not do anything and not pay attention.
The CDC then is also in conversation with the WHO, the World Health Organization. This administration has decided to withdraw from the WHO. What does that mean?
We're all connected. So just like, you know, you want to know what's happening in West Texas on the global scale, just like we want other countries to tell us when they have outbreaks, other countries want the U.S. to say when they have outbreaks. And the WHO is that coordinating force there where they're working with governments around the world and getting information from those governments and then reporting it out to all other countries. And so they collect all sorts of data, and it's in the world's kind of our best interests for, you know, other countries to report to them, and that goes for the whole world. And so there was an executive order to withdraw from the WHO. What that means is the WHO has 194 countries that are its members, and it's been this way since the creation of the WHO, and those countries kind of make agreements about what the WHO even looks like. So if you want to shape the WHO, you do that as a member organization. So it's basically an organization that's comprised of its members. So it's not like it's some outside body that's unrelated to us. So withdrawing means that the U.S. would no longer be a part of that organization, meaning it's just other countries and not the U.S.
So what are the downsides of not being part of the WHO? I mean, you can still go to the website and find out what's happening around the world, right? But it sounds like the CDC is no longer in direct contact with the WHO. Is that what it means, or what does it mean?
Yeah, we lose the ability to shape what happens. Like, for example, when there's when all of the countries get together and decide what initiatives they want to push for in global health, and maybe that's prioritizing fighting malaria or combating polio, or maybe it's about saying, no, we need to have basic health care for everyone. The U.S. has typically had a lot of weight in saying what the WHO should do because we have mainly been its largest funder. And so now we're ceding that authority, which means other countries will be able to step in and set the agenda.
Mm-hmm. So we give up our ability to influence.
Yes, exactly.
Finally, I mean, this is a big picture question, and in some ways you've already answered it in this interview, but you have reported on health and global health for many years. What concerns you most about the situation where, let's say, the data aren't gone, but they're intermittent, or they have the potential to no longer be reliable? What concerns you about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of, so from a, you know, straight health perspective, as I mentioned, ignoring diseases doesn't make them go away. It just means we lose track of what's happening. And as a result, if you can't see where the problems are, then you can't address those problems quickly. And then you're only going to notice that there's a problem once it's really huge and in your face. So once you have, let's say, you know, once we have HIV rates that are much higher, that takes time to get there. So that's not something you see the next day. And once it happens, it's really hard to kind of solve that problem. So obscuring what's happening helps no one. So that's one dangerous part of it. Another part is also trust. We want people to be able to look at this Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report like the pretty boring and dry read that it is. It's never been paused before in its history, and that's because it's supposed to be a purely scientific process that gets it out. It's not supposed to have a political lens over it. It's not setting policies, so that's something different. But people need to trust that what they see in that report is really what's happening, and that the recommendations are free from political interference, that they're being made based on what the evidence says and not on what politicians want it to say. You know, I have no sign that, you know, this will continue necessarily, but if that's what we start seeing, the fear is that people on either side of the aisle won't trust the CDC, that we'll start thinking that it's just sort of bending to the will of whatever political leanings it has, and that's what we don't want. We want to look at it like, I'm going to Egypt, what vaccines do I need?
needs to remain objective.
It needs to remain as objective as it can be. And just, it needs to be based on what the evidence is saying. We want to know that it's collecting data in kind of a systematic way and reporting it in a systematic way and analyzing it and then using the results of that analysis to give some advice.
That sounds boring, but that's sometimes what science is.
We want the CDC to be pretty boring.
Amy Maxman, thank you so much for talking to us.
You're welcome.
Amy Maxman is a public health reporter at KFF Health News.
Next, the federal funding cuts have affected many science agencies.
Where we're seeming to be leaning is toward maybe dismantling NOAA, maybe privatizing it.
From hurricane forecasts to long-term climate trends, how will changes to NOAA affect our ability to deal with extreme weather events? That's next.
We're looking at how cuts to federally funded science may affect the collection and sharing of important information. This episode is called Disappearing Data.
The withdrawal of federal support is being felt by the entire science community. Science journalists are feeling it too. Big picture science is meeting this challenge in a way that is more adaptive and journalistically independent. We recently parted ways with the SETI Institute to become independent. Don't worry, we'll continue to produce episodes about the latest research breakthroughs and big ideas in science, as well as keep raising an eyebrow in our regular Skeptic Check episodes. But your support of our program is even more important now. It's easy to support independent science journalism by donating to Big Picture Science on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/bigpicturescience. There you'll get early access to ad-free versions of every episode, as well as other perks like bonus content. This is a time to stand up for science and science journalism. Please join us at patreon.com/bigpicturescience. Thank you. The collection of global temperatures, ocean currents, and atmospheric data is the reason meteorologists are able to do this.
Let's go now to NBC 15 Chief Meteorologist Alan Seals. Alan?
Fortunately for us, the Gulf has calmed down, and the surf is actually calming, too. In the Caribbean, there is still a tropical storm, and there are two tropical disturbances out in the Atlantic.
Proposed funding and job cuts at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, raise serious concerns about its ability to effectively track hurricanes and forecast weather, and thereby protect public safety. If proposed cuts move forward, nearly 20% of NOAA's 13,000-person workforce would be eliminated.
But NOAA does much more than bring you the weather. To give an overview of the broad types of data NOAA collects and how cuts to the agency might threaten their collection, we're joined by Alan Seals, whom you just heard. He has since retired from broadcast meteorology. He's president-elect of the American Meteorological Society. Joining us, too, is the chief meteorologist at the nonprofit Climate Central, an independent group of researchers and science journalists who study and report on climate.
Alan, let's start with you. We just played a clip of one of your weather reports on NBC during the 2023 hurricane season, and I've heard you say in other interviews that 90% of what was shown behind you on television came from NOAA. Can you explain what you meant?
The general public looks at us on TV and says, oh, that's the weather person. They know everything. They have all the information I need to know. But the truth of the matter is we are a partnership with NOAA, and NOAA is basically the foundation of all weather data for the United States and somewhat for other countries, which we'll talk about partnerships in a little bit. But start with the fact of whether you're watching TV or you're looking at your weather app, the satellite, the radar. There are a few TV stations and private companies that have their own radars, but in general, the radar network and the satellite network around the country are NOAA data. We give you the current conditions. What's the temperature at the airport? No one lives at the airport, but still, that's the reference because the airports have a long climatological history that's been quality controlled and maintained by NOAA. And part of that data also includes weather balloons, which go up into the sky, giving us a three-dimensional picture. So basically, that's the majority of what you see on TV weather and also on weather apps.
So the diversity and the amount of data that NOAA collects is impressive. And Bernadette, can you add to that list that Alan provided?
So yes, it is incredible how much data is collected by NOAA. The oceans, at many levels, from buoys, from near the coast, from deeper out into the ocean, from deeper down into the water. So we've got oceans, and that's a big part of NOAA. The atmosphere and all layers of the atmosphere, from what we're experiencing down here. And that's just the immediacy. But then what we do with this data, right? It's data not for just this moment, but over decades and in some cases, centuries. And that's really critical when we get into climate versus weather, because we understand trends in things when you have a complete data set over time. When you interrupt a data set, as sometimes happens around the world because of unstable governments or whatever it may be, or instrumentation going out or lack of funding, then you ruin that data set in some ways.
And we'll talk more about what happens when we interrupt those data sets. You know, the word data can come off as kind of dry and sort of abstract. I don't think I've met two people who are more passionate about data collection than the two of you. You make it sound exciting.
It's in our lives every day. Your GPS is constantly taking data, calculating, projecting, helping you to get from point A to point B safely. And really, that's exactly what NOAA's doing. It's all about taking information to make life safer, to make our properties safer, and to help us understand the world better.
Data is fun. And I can tell you that Alan and I are not the only ones that get this excited. Our entire field of atmospheric science and meteorology genuinely gets excited about this. We do so much with data. It's how we learn what's happening, as Alan was saying. So data really is a lot of fun. I think people should embrace it.
Now, Alan, I was surprised to learn that NOAA pilots are among those that fly into hurricanes. Certainly, you've covered a lot of hurricane news and forecasting in your career. Can you give us an idea of the kind of data they collect and how maybe not having those pilots might impact upcoming hurricane season? But let's just start with these fearless pilots. What are they doing flying into hurricanes?
Yeah, and I'll to put a wider context into perspective, the Air Force Reserve has hurricane hunters, and NOAA has hurricane hunters. And I've had a chance to fly with the Air Force Reserve three times into hurricanes. Now, they were all low-end Cat 1s.
I mean, you flew into a hurricane. That's pretty cool.
Well, here's the coolest part. The last hurricane I flew into, there were two flight meteorologists on board, and it turns out they were both students of mine at the University of South Alabama. So that's the coolest part. The three of us together in the eye of a storm in the Southern Gulf. It takes you a couple of hours to get to the storm. Once you're there, you crisscross and you're constantly measuring information and you're just going back and forth within the storm. The data that they're collecting is not only at flight level, but also using weather sensors all the way down to the sea surface. So number one, they drop an instrument into the toward the ocean, which is almost like a weather balloon going in the opposite direction. And as that drops sonde, that's the name of the instrument, falls, it's measuring temperature, pressure, humidity, and wind literally every second, and sometimes multiple times a second. And that's how we are learning and improving. The National Hurricane Center, if you look at their data over the years, they show, and I don't remember the statistics, but they show that those NOAA Hurricane Hunter flights do improve the ability of models to predict hurricanes. So there's a huge benefit with that.
And Bernadette, could you explain how those data help people make decisions in times of hurricanes or other weather crises?
So if you're in a coastal community, it is not easy to evacuate. So in our changing climate, we're seeing with warming water, these hurricanes go from a category 1 to a 3 overnight or within those ranges, I mean, plus or minus. And so a category 3 coming at you versus a category 1 is fundamentally different. And the risk goes through the roof. And you can't just all of a sudden evacuate everyone in 12 hours and activate all the systems you need to in the emergency management chain. So it's really critical that we get that data in the moment. And get a good read on how things are changing and then how that feeds into how we prepare.
Yeah, and an excellent example is Hurricane Milton last year, which blew up tremendously in the Gulf of Mexico. When you forecast weather, you take data, you project it forward. Typically, there's a six-hour window before you get a whole new data set. But with the hurricane hunters in Milton, that's how we knew that the wind speed rapidly increased, and that changed the forecast.
Well, Bernadette and Alan, the current administration has proposed a 20% cut to jobs at NOAA. How many of those job cuts have gone through? And can you both comment on what kind of effects you are seeing now to NOAA and to NOAA's ability perhaps to collect data?
Yeah, I learned over time in my career to be able to say, I don't know. And that's one of those I don't knows. And the problem is, if you ask that question an hour from now, there could be a different number. And tomorrow there could be a different scenario. We know that people were probationary employees were supposedly let go, and then they were told to be brought back, and some were put on leave. And I use the analogy of a relationship where your partner says out of nowhere, hey, you know, we're done. We don't need to be together. And then a week later, hey, come on back. Please come. I want you to come back. That's what's happening, I think, with NOAA.
Alan summed it up pretty nicely. We really don't know. There have been people let go, and it's already understaffed. But then there have been people brought back. And this changes possibly from hour to hour, day to day. We have seen some of the data collection interrupted, not on large scales, on individual scales, where a weather balloon launch did not go up in a couple of locations, but not in a systemic way for anything needing to be shut down quite yet. But every time we lose that data, we limit our ability. I shouldn't say we limit our ability to keep people safe. We lessen that ability, because the more data that we have, the better we can be at really keeping people safe and prepared.
Where we're seeming to be leaning is toward maybe dismantling NOAA, maybe privatizing it. And a private company is about profit. So right now, NOAA is serving a critical purpose of giving all people in the United States weather data on equal footing, regardless of your income or zip code, because that's the way weather works. Aside from being unsettling, if you work for NOAA, I look at my students who I teach, and they are very cautious and scared about what their futures are in the weather industry. So even right now, I saw an article earlier today that a lot of scientists are now putting in applications overseas in other countries. I'm afraid that we are losing talent, folks who will carry us through the next several decades.
The thing is, the private industry needs public data to function in the form that it's in right now. That's where we are. And many people from the private sector have come out and said, we need to work in collaboration with NOAA. So that's one thing to put out here. Another thing is that NOAA, National Weather Service in particular, and we're focusing obviously more on the weather side than the ocean side, which is a huge chunk of NOAA, but that's where Alan and I have spent more of our time. And we're about to kick into our tropical season. Those oceans are heating up even more, and that's when everything gets going. And so what happens in the National Weather Service around a big event is it's a surge of attention needed. It is a surge of activity for what that office has to respond to. And that requires more people. They're working the radars. They are working the watches, the warnings, getting them out. They're talking to the emergency managers on the ground. They need to know what cooling center to open up when and where. And it all just requires more. And when you have less to go into the season and you lose what's even there, that puts everyone at risk.
If this continues, can you be very clear as to how these cuts might affect NOAA's ability to collect data? Because the argument from the administration is that a smaller workforce would be more efficient, and the data collection itself won't stop. So it may be speculation, or maybe you know, but could you help us understand how these cuts might affect the quality and the access of data?
So my concerns with NOAA's cuts, on a human level, it's about people and how you treat people and how you treat career scientists. But on a data level, even if the data collection remains the same, following the data collection, there's data analysis, quality check, and even on a local basis, the National Weather Service radar that scans your community, no matter where you live in the United States, there's at least one radar that covers your community. It's hardware that's run by software. And if either of those has a hiccup, you have to bring in a technician to fix it. So as you start cutting people, you start losing the ability to rapidly respond to hardware and software issues, communications issues. This is the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina this year. And during Hurricane Katrina, the National Weather Service in New Orleans lost their ability to communicate. They could not communicate to the outside world. And there were other neighboring National Weather Service offices that literally took over in a seamless transition. If you start removing people, you start losing the ability to have the flexibility to make those changes.
Bernadette, I want to ask you about the global perspective and the way in which NOAA provides access to data around the globe. You describe the open access model of NOAA as a game changer around the world. And what do you mean by that? And how would an interruption in collecting data affect other countries?
So we are the world's leader for weather and climate data. There is good data around the world, but it's not always accessible. Europe has great data, but it's not just open access to everyone. India's data is pretty good too, but it's hard to access. So to understand what's going on, we need that data to understand how things are changing, how they're trending, how we need to prepare both in the immediate short term with our weather and in the longer term with our changing climate. Where we plant, how we plant, when we harvest, when we need to migrate certain crops because we're seeing this shift in the zones. And all of that's really critical, especially to countries that don't have the same checks and balances that we have here in the United States. And so the United States and NOAA has had this open access model that the world can tap into.
Weather moves from west to east around the planet, whether you're in the Northern Hemisphere or the Southern Hemisphere. So for us to figure out United States weather for next week, we need to know the weather in Asia this week and the weather even in Europe, because it simply circulates the entire planet. If any large country, such as the United States, all of a sudden degrades the quality of their weather data or limits the quality of their data, every other country to some degree will have a slightly less accurate forecast. We don't know how much less accurate it's going to be. But as you start removing data, you cannot increase accuracy. You can only see it diminish.
Bernadette, I wonder if we could say a bit more about how, among the many things that NOAA does, it does collect data about our oceans, for example, and also the atmosphere that are used in climate modeling. And some of those data inform the IPCC. Could you just give us an overview on how those climate data help those global reports?
Absolutely. So for those who don't know, the IPCC, as we refer to it, is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This is a massive assessment report that is put out every 6 to 7 years, currently just starting the seventh assessment. And it looks at every way you can look at how climate is changing, from the historic data through to how it's impacting people and our changing weather, our rising seas, our melting glaciers, and they are open access and they are critical. All of this is put into an IPCC report. We could have three different sessions just on that.
Is there anything else that either one of you would like to add about what you're worried about that we haven't touched on? Sort of where your thoughts are going now as we see these funding cuts to research and to jobs in NOAA, but perhaps across science in general?
Yeah, science in general, it's life. We all started from a biological process. And when we perish, it's another earth process that's all about science. And science is what has extended the life expectancy of people. Science is what has given us all the conveniences of electronics, of orbiting the earth in a space station, going up and down like it's no big deal. So it's one of those things that we take for granted. When it fails, when it stops, when it disappears, then people will be in shock.
A couple of things here. One, NOAA is not the only one being attacked right now or challenged or whatever word you want to use. This is happening across all of our agencies, which contain data and a lot of very mission-driven, passionate people who, again, are trying to keep people safe and prepared. It's across health. This is across the EPA, DOE, DOT, all of these groups that are doing really great stuff. So it's not just NOAA. And we spend time talking about that. But more broadly for the science, I come to a quote here. I recently heard Rush Holt. He is a New Jersey guy who was a scientist and then was a politician and then led AAAS. And he said recently, this is quoted from him, science is special. It seeks and demands evidence. It solves problems, serious problems. It is the most successful path to truth. It is a civilizing force. It pushes back fear, ignorance, and darkness. And I couldn't say that any better. And that's why I wrote it down when he said it. And I want to give him due credit in that moment.
Well, Bernadette Woods Plackey and Alan Seals, thank you so much for joining us together to talk about this. We really appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Molly.